Hello, how are you? Good, good to hear it. All right, let's get the show started with to catch you up on the wonderful things that are going on in the world, specifically coming out of the White House from the quote-unquote Trump administration. And if you're a person who voted for Donald Trump and you're one of those people where if Donald Trump stood in the middle of Manhattan and shot somebody, you'd still support him, then this isn't going to mean anything to you. Otherwise, you probably have heard that just a few days ago, Michael Flynn was appointed by Donald Trump to be National Security Advisor, a cabinet position. Then they come to find out a few days ago that Michael Flynn was from August of 2016 to November of 2016 for about 4 months, was a secret agent for Turkey. For the country of Turkey, Michael Flynn represented Turkey secretly. Of course, Turkey not being the friendliest country in the world to us, as a matter of fact, they were the ones that allowed ISIS to come in and set up shop in their country. We've begun working with Turkey, but not so much really. Michael Flynn's job, hired by Turkey itself as a secret agent, was to, in Washington, this is during the campaign as well that this took place time-wise, to lobby for Turkey favorably in Washington, D.C. For this, secret agent Michael Flynn was paid $530,000, over $500,000 for a four-month period, to make Turkey look good to the United States. He admits that he was hired to do this in a secretive sense. He was a secret agent for Turkey. Donald Trump, his employer, finds out about it and says, this is a witch hunt. It's a witch hunt. It's the press. It's the media on a witch hunt for my cabinet members, and I fully support Michael Flynn. The next day, President Trump claims that he fires Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn claims that he resigned respectfully. So Michael Flynn is no longer National Security Advisor. So that's just a wonderful, smooth situation there. The President of the United States, in his perfect and wonderful vetting process, because the President, he says he does everything perfectly, no one does anything better than he does, he appoints National Security Advisor to a secret, to Michael Flynn, who is a secret agent for Turkey. Or was recently. Either Trump knew about it and was trying to pass it through and didn't care, or if he didn't know about it, his vetting process sucks the big one. Mr. Vetter, Mr. Keeping This Country Secure, who perfectly vets all these people, apparently doesn't know how to vet a thing. That's number one. Number two, just yesterday, EPA chief Scott Pruitt, again, a man that was appointed by Donald Trump as a cabinet position. EPA, of course, being the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, says publicly in a statement that he does not believe that car emissions and factory emissions, the carbon monoxide, all those things, the dirty things that are spilled into the air, he doesn't believe that that has anything to do with climate change, if climate change actually exists. But his particular quote is that he doesn't believe that factory emissions and car emissions have anything to do with destroying the environment. That's your EPA chief that was appointed by Donald Trump. Okay, I say no more at this time. Let's get the show started. Now you're up to date. There's so much more, but let's just have fun now.
Ron Van Dam is an experienced talk show host. Do not attempt to try this at home.
Quote unquote fun.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird if you like that sort of thing.
Oh, hold on tight. They have gotten a bit weird.
Whatever.
Ba-da-ba-bum, Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba- Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show. You knew that, huh? Did you know that? Yeah, it wasn't a mistake. You did it on purpose.
Sit back, relax, grab a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, whatever your liquid libation may be in the morning, and join us as we take a look at the world around us. As much as it's a pleasure to be with you, the pleasure is actually all yours. And now, here's your host, Ron Van Dam.
Hi, welcome to the program. I am your host. Can I get you anything? Would you like a beverage of some sort? Something with ice cubes in it? Or do you want a tea bag? Do you want a tea bag with me? Let's tea bag together, shall we? What the hell does that mean, actually? What does that mean? I don't think it's right. I don't think it's a good thing, but let's have a tea bag together. Let's get tea bagged. What does that mean? I know nothing of which I speak. Welcome to the program. I have got a wonderful, wonderful interview coming up just in a bit on the show. This is fascinating crap. Jonathan Sanger, does that name mean anything to you? Maybe, probably not. He was the major producer for the film The Elephant Man. I guess some of you weren't alive then. Some of you still aren't alive now. It's so funny. Elephant Man was quite an epic film. He spearheaded that whole project, that whole motion picture. He worked with Mel Brooks on the film High Anxiety. He did many television shows, produced many television shows, and he's joining us today on the program because he's written a book about what goes on behind the scenes, specifically during the shooting of The Elephant Man. It's a fascinating book. Get behind the scenes, down and dirty, to what it takes to put a film together. And he talks about his entire film career and producing career and television career. It's very interesting. That'll happen on today's show. Okay, kids, how you doing, by the way? You doing all right? I got a question for you, and it's not going to be pleasant. But it's important that I ask you this.
What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today, today? What are you wearing? What are you wearing? What are you wearing today, today?
I'll tell you a funny story, which isn't all that funny, really. When I was much younger, probably about, 16, 17 years old, there was a fad going around where men didn't wear underpants. And if you're a woman, I don't think you'll quite understand the complexities involved here. The pants of the underage hold in the organisms. And when you don't wear that, the organisms are just pretty much hanging out, I suppose is the best way of putting it. And I remember, I don't know why it came up, to be honest with you, but I remember trying on a pair of jeans, and I thought to myself, I'm going to go under pantless. I will not have pants on under my pants. And it was a very freeing, I felt naked. Even though I had jeans on, I felt naked because I had no underpants on. I started my day, and I went through the day, and I realized that that's really great as long as you never sit down or take wide strides when you're walking. In other words, the freedom of that is very constricted to you not moving at all. Within about 15 minutes, my private parts hurt like they were just slammed by a truck. It was not pleasant. It was not freeing. It was horrible. And that's how I learned the value of the underpants. I don't think women have those problems because their organs are internal. A man's organs are out there for hurting. They are out there for hurting. I remember going to the bathroom and unzipping my jeans, in which case, of course, you are totally exposed to the world now. And I remember doing my duty, so to speak, and then standing up and going to zip up my pants to continue my day. Then I learned the other function that the other underpants play in one's lifestyle. If you don't think and you're not careful, things get caught up in the zipper. The pubicity hairs, the hairs that extend from this one particular organ, which looks like an octopus on steroids, the hair got caught in the zipper. And the zipper, if it went up, it was excruciating. If it went down, it was excruciating. I was stuck and couldn't do a damn thing about it. Who do you tell? Do you run to your mother? Hey, guess what? Guess how smart I am. I got my pubic hair stuck in my zipper. You don't do that. You don't. She would have never spoken to me again. You don't tell anybody about it. Eventually, I got myself free. It was an excruciatingly painful experience. Then I decided I must talk to somebody about this and about this horrible experience so that other kids don't try this at home. And then I realized what I'll do is I'll get myself a talk show decades later, and then I'll tell everybody about it then. So that's what I'm doing. This has become a public service announcement that I never thought I would ever do.
It was unbelievably painful.
It was unbelievably painful. It was horrible. It was unbelievably painful. But that's the value of pants, ladies and gentlemen. That's the value of the pants.
Have you ever wondered how Ron Van Dam manages to sound so damn sexy podcast after podcast after podcast?
No, how?
It's simple. No pants.
Oh, boy.
Ever. Pants are for suckers. You are listening to The Ron Van Dam Show. Pants-free podcasting at its finest.
I do this every single weekday. A new show every weekday of a long time, for a long time. If you want to binge listen, you can listen to a new show until you die, pretty much, because there's around 600 episodes you can listen to. That's 600 hours. I don't know how you can possibly do something like that. Go to the Facebook page, New England Broadcasting, The Ron Van Dam Show. New England Broadcasting, The Ron Van Dam Show. We're heard on selected radio stations all across the country in a syndicated sense. Also, you can go to newenglandbroadcasting.com, ronvandam.com, or you can go to iTunes, TuneIn Radio, the Podbean Network, and many other outlets so that you can enjoy this program in many various ways with your pants on, hopefully.
Now it's time for one of Ron's funny stories. You could practically hear the quotes around funny, couldn't you?
I am in a constant struggle to lose weight. When I was in my early 20s, I weighed nothing. I literally weighed. When I got on the scale, it said zero. I weighed nothing at all. I was skin and bones. You could see my ribs. I had a nickname of Bones because you could see my bones sticking out of me. And I also had little soap dishes in my shoulders because my bones would show up and it would cause little soap dishes between my neck and my shoulders. You could put a bar of soap in there and the bar of soap would not slip out. I was extremely skinny. I was 6'3" tall and didn't have an ounce of fat on me. I thought I was emaciated, and I thought my life will be wonderful. I can eat anything I want, and I did. And then when I hit 40 years old, all of a sudden my body said, okay, that's enough of that. And the pounds started coming on. I'm not fat. The government calls me obese, but guess what? I call the government obese, so I guess we're good. I'm a good weight, but I would love to lose some poundage. So I'm constantly trying to eat properly, a constant struggle in my mind. Have fun and eat what you'd like. Food is wonderful. And then on the other side of it, you be careful. Don't eat what you like. Eat healthy things and lose some weight, you bastard. So I've talked about earlier in the week that I had some surgery on my nose because of some skin cancer that they found. It was removed. Thank you for your cards and letters. And I'm good. But I'm healing on my nose. And I wanted to treat myself to something. So yesterday, actually a couple of days ago, I went to the supermarket with bandages on my nose. I look ridiculous. I look like the Elephant Man, which is really, we're going to talk about that pretty much soon. So I went to the supermarket and I bought Breyers ice cream, no sugar added. 80 calories, 3 grams of sugar, and that's it. And I thought, okay, that's very, very healthy. That's fine. I opened up the carton to give myself a little ice cream treat, and it tasted like foam. That's what it tastes like. Flavored foam. It had the consistency of ice cream, not foamy, but like styrofoam. Styrofoam more than foam. Styrofoam ice cream. It was the consistency was just disgusting. So I got in my car and I went back to the supermarket. You can't return ice cream because you're stupid. You can't go up to the customer service booth at a supermarket and say, excuse me, I'd like to return this ice cream that I opened because I'm stupid and I bought stuff that tasted like styrofoam. That's embarrassing. It's bad enough my nose is bandaged up. Why embarrass myself any further than that? Maybe I look stupid. Why not prove it to them? So I didn't do that. I went back to the supermarket and I went back to the ice cream case, the ice cream area, the area of the ice cream. And there I see Edie's or Eddie, E-D-Y. I still don't know how to pronounce it. And they had a no sugar added, 3 grams of sugar. And it was chocolate something. They come up with these stupid names like chocolate explosion or chocolate, triple chocolate delight or something, some kind of cute chocolate name. And I figure, okay, how many calories here? 110 calories. Okay, that's okay. Only 3 grams of sugar. This is wonderful. No sugar added to the ice cream. It's got a little Splenda in it. That's splendid. I bring it home, and I can't wait to try it because I love chocolate. And I open up the container of ice cream, and it's just icky. It's kind of freezer burned, and the chocolate, it tastes like bad pudding. It tastes like bad chocolate pudding, like someone left the chocolate pudding out, and there's something tremendously wrong with it. Now I have 2 containers of ice cream, and I don't want to eat either one of them, but damn it, I want ice cream. I go back to the supermarket, and I'm looking around. I said, damn it, I'm going to find some. Finally, so I go back to the counter, and I see the Edie's or the Eddie's. Again, I have no idea what it is. And they had the Neapolitan. Neapolitan means that there's chocolate, and then there's a big border of chocolate, and then it goes into vanilla, and then it goes into strawberry. So it's got 3 flavors in one, and it looks rather creamy. I don't know why they call it Neapolitan. It's chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry separated is what it's called, is what it should be called. I bring that home. I open it up, and that is perfect. It's creamy. It's tasty. It's great. Ladies and gentlemen, I have 2 open containers of ice cream, one Breyers and one Edie's Eddie's, whatever the fuck that is, and I'm selling it on eBay. The problem is it'll probably melt by the time it gets to you, but hey, it's eBay. What the hell? Any takers?
Really funny story, Ron. But then again, I'm in the third grade.
Do you know that there is one item that can not only increase your home's beauty, but its value? That would be placemats. Hello, I'm George Karanatakopoulos, owner of George K's Wholesale Placemat Warehouse, your one stop for all your placemat needs. We have a placemat for every room of your house. That's right, placemats are not just for the dining room anymore. Anywhere you might make a spill, or maybe where you eat, like in front of the TV. I do it all the time like you. You want a placemat. We have fancy placemats, like in bamboo or teak. That's right, teak. Nice plastic laminate ones for no stains, even blue. We can custom make you placemats in as little as 2 weeks. Come to our showroom at the intersection of Route 27 and the Holbrook Turnpike. You're going to like what you see. Your placemat is waiting for you at George K's Wholesale Placemat Warehouse.
Jonathan Sanger is a very famous producer in the entertainment industry, produced The Elephant Man, worked with Mel Brooks on High Anxiety and many other projects. Worked with Anne Bancroft on many projects, produced the television series for Lorimar, The Blue Knight, and Eight is Enough, and so many other films and television connections. He's going to join us now.
No, it's my pleasure.
As you know, as you probably know, we've talked about you earlier in the program. You're an Academy Award-winning film producer. And this is a story behind the story, apparently.
Yes, well, it was the first movie that I got to produce, yeah. And it was the story of 1 year in my life, really, from going from being I had worked in the film business. I was working as a production manager and an assistant director, mm-hmm. And this was my opportunity to move up and become a producer, and it was a pretty unusual awakening for me, to go from the work that I had been doing to actually being partially responsible for getting this movie made. So it was really quite an exciting year.
Now, for those that weren't born yet, makes me sound very old as well. This film was actually a phenomenon. It was an art film. It was a popular film. It had stars in it. It was accepted by the public, the critics. It was a big deal back then. Did you know when you went into producing that this had potential to you?
Actually, it's one of those situations where, and I'm sure I've said this before, but, if I knew then what I know now, I probably wouldn't have even started the process, because it was the farthest thing from being something that I expected to be a popular success. I mean, I was, I was hoping it would be, certainly. But David Lynch and I, who, we spent a great deal of time together during the making of this, and we would go out to dinner once a week while we were in London making the film, and all that we hoped for was that the movie would open in one theater and we could go and take our friends. I mean, that was the level of our ambition at the time. So we were quite surprised by the fact that the film kind of outpaced us and our hopes for it. I mean, we were flabbergasted at the positive responses we've got at the time, and that we were in the awards conversations that year And you know, it was a very heady experience. Yeah. You know, for a first film, hard to imagine, and in some ways not necessarily the best thing, because I began to believe that that was the way it always was going to be, and it so rarely is. You know.
Now you were pretty much up there when this began, working with some pretty prestigious television shows for that time, and with Mel Brooks, as I understand it. Go on.
No. I mean, I had met Mel Brooks through a friend of mine who was also a writer who had worked for Mel, and that was Barry Levinson. Yeah. And Barry, Barry introduced me to Mel, and Mel needed an assistant director, so I wound up working as Mel's assistant director on the movie High Anxiety. Right. Mel hired me, and during that period, after I'd worked with him on the movie, I came across this script, and I was looking to find something that I might be able to produce, and never thinking, I mean, it was never something I automatically thought Mel would be the right guy to bring it to. Yeah. It just happened that through a series of unusual coincidences, he picked up the script and read it and asked me who owned it, and at that point, I had optioned the script and told him that I did, and, you know, he told me that he wanted to start a company to make movies other than his own comedies, and he would love to consider this movie as one of the first that he would get involved in helping to raise the financing for.
Yeah.
So that kind of was the very beginnings of it.
But it was the same for you. You had worked with Lorimar and on television programs,
sure.
and a lot of them comedies, especially with Mel. Were you looking for something to sink your teeth in that was more of a dramatic, significant piece?
I was looking for something that I would respond to, that I felt I could really, I mean, I knew that to produce a film, I mean, I'd seen the process, and I knew it was going to be at least a year of my life, and I really wanted it to be something that really counted for me, and was something that I felt I could spend that amount of time on. So yeah, it was something that when I read it, I was instantly taken with the story, and thought it was something that perhaps I could get made.
Were you involved with the casting, or was that given out?
No. The casting, I was involved in every aspect of the film. In fact, very much involved in the casting. In fact, the principal casting of Anthony Hopkins and Bancroft were early decisions that
you had worked with Ann before.
I had worked with Ann recently before that. I'd been an associate producer on a movie that she directed called Fatso, and so I knew her quite well. And the interesting thing was that, a lot of people assumed that it was that Mel Brooks kind of told us to use Ann, but it wasn't that way at all. I mean, it was, in fact, David and I talked to Mel about the possibility. We were interested, and he never got involved directly in her choices for movies that she made. He always kind of left that. I mean, he basically said, well, you have to talk to her. And we did. And she responded very positively to the material. And she was also the first person to tell us that she thought Anthony Hopkins would be a great choice if we could get him for the other lead role. So it was, she was very helpful in that process.
It's probably funny looking back at it how everything clicked, and had it not clicked like that, it may not have been where it ended up. So I mean, that's kind of amazing in itself. When you look back at it, was it a monumental task, or was it something that flowed?
Well, it was, it wasn't a monumental task in the sense that we didn't really have a sense of what it might be. We just knew that we were out to make a movie, and once David Lynch came along, and I had met David and made the decision that I wanted to go with him. It flowed very, very, very well, and most of the events that happened, yes, there were a lot of very difficult times trying to get it done, But you know, as I say, it was a situation where there was one positive event after another that made it possible. Yeah. And you know, there was a kind of thing where you couldn't have imagined that it would have, if it would have worked, and then it did. You know, we just had some very, very good luck, and we knew what we wanted. So that was, you know, it made it a lot easier that way.
I'm going to ask you something from one New York boy to another New York boy.
Sure.
How did you end up leaving Brooklyn? I mean, you actually started your career in New York with some pretty prestigious films back there. You're still in California, as I understand it.
Well, I'm in California now, but I do recently, actually, about 10, 15 years ago, my wife and I wound up getting an apartment in New York because I missed it so much. And
go.
I still have a lot of my relatives. My sister lives in New York. So yeah, I mean, I'm a Brooklyn boy. I grew up in Brooklyn I always was fascinated by the entertainment business, although, it wasn't something that my family thought was the best idea for me to get into, but
they never do.
You know,
yeah.
No, they wanted me to be a doctor, and most of my relatives were doctors, so I had a lot of those, and I was pre-med in college. But at a certain point, I said, "No, I think really I want to try this," and I got involved in theater, and that was the beginning of something that hasn't ended. So you know, it was really. A great experience.
Well, not only did you have the talent, but you seem to have hooked up with the right people at the right times, which is how many businesses work.
Well, you know, it's the funny thing. When I started as an assistant director, I was working in New York. There weren't a lot of movies being made in New York at the time, mainly because of some of the union issues in New York, and a lot of people that I was. Friendly with at the time didn't want to work on just a few days of a movie. They wanted to work on a whole film. I decided that anytime someone came to town, even if they were only going to be shooting a couple of days in New York, if I had a chance to get involved, I would. And it served me well because I got to meet a lot of people in those days, and those were the people that wound up forming the foundation of my friendships later when I got further into the business. Sure. So even if I only worked a few days on a movie, you know, I developed a kind of a good list of people that I could call later when I needed them.
Let's talk about the book itself. So here it is, decades and decades later, and here comes the book. What prompted you to tell the story? Was it that significant in that sense that it brought you back to that film again?
Well, it was a couple of things. I mean, I've been working in the last few years. I've been making movies, and they've been independent movies. When I say independent, I mean that they're funded outside of the studio system, even though they're released usually by major studios.
Right.
And Elephant Man, I look back to that movie and realized it was one of the very first movies that was made that way, and it was the beginning of something. Mm-hmm. When I say that, what I mean by that is that nowadays, when you make an independent movie, you have to raise the money, you have to do banking, there's a whole lot of things that go into the process, and a lot of it has to do with selling rights, getting, you know, having ancillary markets, all the things that are very present today, but weren't very present back in the time we made this movie. Nevertheless, that was the way it was made. I mean, when Mel became involved, it was really a situation where he went around with me and helped me to raise the money to make the movie. Uh-huh. And so at the end of the day, even though we were released by a major studio, Paramount Pictures, domestically, and EMI Foreign, Mel's company ultimately owns the movie, and that is almost never done. You know, I mean, it was a very unusual situation. Mm. And when I look back on my experiences, it was really a lot of it was based on not having any fear of it. You know, I didn't. I didn't know what I didn't know. So right. I went straight ahead and kept trying, you know, it was the beginning of something, both for me and in the process of the way a lot of movies are made today.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. The book's available everywhere, obviously. Is there a way that people can follow you and check up with what you're doing without being too weird about it?
I'll tell you, I have a website. My website is just www.jonathansangerproductions.com. Mm-hmm. And I have, little pieces on just about all the movies that I have been involved in. Yeah. I have two movies that are coming out this year. Both were made in New York State or New York City. Cool. I like working in New York.
Cool. Are they your productions? Or are they indie productions? Or are they involved?
They're independent productions. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. One is called Chapter and Verse, which is coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Yep.
And it was a movie that was shot in Harlem a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And the other one is called Marshall, which is a movie actually about a case, an early case in the career of Thurgood Marshall when he was a young lawyer in the 1940s. And we shot it up in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, very cool. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, I guess vicariously, because a lot of us are into that industry, but we're not necessarily in it. So this is kind of fun. And you've been blessed, and I'm sure that's the way you feel.
I do. Yeah. No, it's been a great run. I've had a good time doing it.
Well, the book is The Passion Behind the Movie Making the Elephant Man, a producer's memoir. Pick it up and get into a different world of actually it's an interesting story of achievement and happenstance and talent and all that. It's kind of involves everything. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That was interesting. I thought it was interesting. Did you think it was interesting? I thought it was interesting. It must be a great life to have that fantasy life of putting together motion pictures and shows, you know, living in the fantasy world and then presenting it to the public. Yeah. As you know, so-called President Trump's travel ban number two, the revised version, is being challenged by various states such as Hawaii, Massachusetts, and others. Let's see how this works out as we continue to shine the light of democracy across the world. I guess that's what we're doing.
Far, we've been traveling far, without a home, but not without a star. Close, hang on to a dream. On the boats and on the planes, they're coming to America, never looking back.
Never quite understood the travel ban thing. I mean, there are certain countries where if people traveling to certain countries would be vetted a lot more seriously. I mean, like, padded down, like, heavy. You know, I get that. But to actually ban them completely because of where they're coming from, that's like saying everybody from here is a rapist and a murderer and a criminal. Oh, wait a minute. That's Mexico.
Freedom's light burning warm. Freedom's light burning warm.
Why isn't there a travel ban from Mexico if they're all rapists? I don't know. We'll just build a wall and have the Americans pay for it in their sales tax. How about that idea?
Everywhere around the world.
Because that's what's going to happen.
They're coming to America.
There'll be a tariff on goods coming in from Mexico. a lot of American companies use parts and use goods from Mexico, and then they sell it here in America. They distribute it. There would be tariffs on that, according to Trump. That's how we pay for this fucking wall. And that means the American public, if they want a product that had anything to do with Mexico at all, you'll be paying more money. And you won't know it came from Mexico. And once some products go up in money and in price, all products go up in price. That's called competition. It's called setting the level of the economy. And who is going to pay for the wall? The American people. Through their purchases. Through the tariff costs that it costs American companies to import and distribute, which is a good percentage of our goods. Oh well, what are you going to do?
Sweet land of liberty.
I really don't like to get political because I'd rather just laugh with you. So, whatever. All right, we're out of time. I wish you peace. Have a wonderful, wonderful day or number of days that you may have. Join me the next weekday for a brand new show. Until then, I do wish you peace. Goodbye. Be careful, please. Use your brain before you do things. That's all I ask. Use your brain. Just don't do things because they're happening. Question it. Think. Be intelligent. Be better.